This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's episode, The Spectator's deputy editor Freddie Gray and Janet Daly from The Daily Telegraph will be discussing the seemingly unstoppable rise of Donald Trump as he fights for the Republican Party nomination. Can anyone get in his way now? I'll also be talking to The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, who asks how David Cameron is managing to buck the crisis in the centre-right around the world. What is the secret to the PM's success, and can it last? And are the Oscars racist? Spectator columnist Rod Little questions why black actors and actresses are missing out on being nominated, and whether those boycotting the Oscars have a point. He'll be joined by Daily Telegraph film critic Tim Robey, who says the Academy has a big problem with racial diversity. So with the first Republican contest in Iowa just 12 days away, and with the Donald soaring in the polls, it looks as though Trump is all but certain to be the party's nominee. In his cover piece for this week's Spectator, Freddie Gray asks how Donald Trump is sweeping away all other contenders. He's joined now by Janet Daly, who says Trump is a fraud and hopes that the absurd Trump fandango will blow itself out. Janet, do you think it will blow itself out, or could we be seeing President Trump at the
end? Well, we certainly aren't seeing President Trump, whether he becomes the nominee or not. But I think he and Ted Cruz might very well, he's hoping, this may be wishful thinking, take each other out, leaving the path free for the real candidate, Marco Rubio, who could actually beat Hillary Clinton, who is eminently beatable. Marco Rubio is a dream candidate for the Republicans, and if they don't go for him, if they actually do go for either Trump or Cruz, they're effectively committing suicide, historical suicide.
Freddie, how has the Republican Party ended up in this predicament, where it has someone who we thought was a joker as its frontrunner?
I think partly it's because for a long time it has imposed on its electorate, on its base, candidates that they were not comfortable with. I mean, for a long time, people have talked about Rubio as the coming star, but he's never really engaged with the electorate. And in fact, I mean, the polls suggest that far from cancelling each other out, Trump and Cruz will run away with it, and Rubio would only come in sort of a distant third, really.
Can I mention the fact that at this stage in 2008, Newt Gingrich was the front runner?
Yes.
I mean, we haven't yet had anybody vote for anybody yet.
This is true. And there's evidence to suggest that the people who say they'll vote for Donald Trump are the people least likely to vote.
Exactly. And this is a very important tactical point, because the reason I said he was a fraud is because he's running an entirely media-dominated celebrity campaign. He's a reality television star. He has no ground operation to speak of. And when you're relying on people who don't usually vote, it's imperative that you have a ground operation. You've got to get them to turn out at the polls. And so far, this is a completely top-heavy candidacy. He's got no real network of ground operation. So the whole thing could actually collapse from the bottom.
I think this is the great hope, but I also think the Republicans, even the higher-up Republicans, the leadership, are beginning to give up themselves. I mean, Michael Steele said last week, I don't see those percentages dissipating.
I don't think Michael Steele, to tell you the truth, I've got a lot of Republican friends in America, I don't think he's a terribly representative voice.
Rich Lowry at National Review said all the people he's spoken to higher up are growing to accept.
Certainly, the Republicans I know are in despair. But I don't think they've actually given up. I think they perhaps are clinging, as I am, to what might be a straw and saying, we haven't had any votes yet. To say this thing is a dead cert when nobody has voted for anybody, is precipitous to say the least.
Yes, I do not say it's a dead cert in the piece.
Presumably those Republicans would give up if Donald Trump did become the party's nominee.
That's difficult to say. What would they do? What have the moderate Labour people done now that Jeremy Corbyn has become leader? You know, there is a real quandary here. Republicans, on the whole, have been more like conservatives in Britain in that, you know, they're quite good at getting the pistol and the bottle of brandy and taking the guy into the library, whereas left-wing parties tend not to be like that. So whether the Republican establishment would depend entirely on how badly he was defeated. If he became the nominee and he was absolutely extinguished in the way Barry Goldwater was, for example, then it would be quite easy for the Republican establishment to move in and take back the power. If he runs it close, that will be a different story.
And Freddie, has he been trying to get attention by becoming more and more ludicrous, or do you think he's tempered his remarks?
Well, there was an interesting Trump rally the other day where a Trump fan was thrown out, and he was heard to be screaming, "Donald's just so boring now." And so I think he is sort of, he's getting a little bit more sensible, and people are saying he's getting a bit cannier in his debating. But of course, outrage is his, backlash is his brand. So if he doesn't have that, then we could start seeing him falling away.
It's true demagoguery. I mean, he is an apolitical person. He has no coherent political program, which is why it's difficult to critique him properly. He's espoused health programs that were to the left of Barack Obama on some things. He's notably socially liberal. He's not really a Republican. He's a friend of the Clintons, and it was Bill Clinton who urged him to run for president. You know, this. The result is that you can easily disconnect him from the Republican base if the people who go for him are intelligent enough to make that kind of judgment and aren't just going for the demagoguery.
So it sounds as though he is purely populist as a politician.
Oh, absolutely. Populist in the absolutely technical sense of the word. Yeah.
And you say that Hillary Clinton is eminently beatable, Janet. Freddie, do you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, at the moment, it looks like she's eminently beatable in the Democratic nomination race. I mean, a poll yesterday had Bernie Sanders, I think, 27 points ahead of her in New Hampshire. So, I mean, she's eminently beatable in many ways.
New Hampshire's not a representative state. I mean, New Hampshire is, you know, that the northeast of the United States is much, much more liberal. He calls himself a socialist. Americans don't vote for socialists. You know, I think that...
I agree. I mean, it would be as crazy as Donald Trump if he were to succeed, but we can't rule anything out at the moment.
So does this mean that the Democrat Party is also in a crisis which is being little reported because of what's happening in the Republicans, Janet?
Yeah, that's the saddest thing, actually, is that Hillary's got a lot of baggage. And a lot of people regard the Clintons as dodgy. There are people who wouldn't vote for her under any circumstances. And the Republicans are throwing that away by making all this noise and, you know, creating such a furore and such a sense of moral outrage about him that everything's getting lost that could be critical of her.
Well, and the polls suggest that the one major Republican candidate who could beat her is Rubio, whereas Trump actually runs better against her than Cruz. So that's why the Republican establishment are beginning to come round to the idea of Trump, I think.
But why not come round to Rubio, who can actually beat her?
Because he's not winning.
I mean,
unless Trump falls apart in a way that doesn't.
And don't forget, Hillary was the front. I mean, Hillary was the heir apparent. She was the front runner, and suddenly Obama came up from behind.
She lost Iowa, though, didn't she?
Yes. But I mean, Trump is going to lose in Iowa. That's why he's brought Sarah Palin in, because he wants to try and reinforce that side, the fundamentalist evangelical side of his campaign. He's worried about Ted Cruz. If he loses big in Iowa and say he loses in New Hampshire, I think his vanity will be so seriously dented that he might actually pull out and decide that he wants to be a kingmaker behind the scenes. I don't think he will stick it if he loses two or three primaries.
Do you think Sarah Palin's backing will help Trump in the way that he hopes?
Not really. I don't think so. I mean, it helps to cancel out the Ted Cruz factor, because had she gone for Ted Cruz, that would have been a serious vote of no confidence in him, in Trump. But she would have been implying that he was not a serious candidate. But I don't think it's going to make that much difference. The people who are in favor of Trump would like her, but, you know, she doesn't add that much.
I think there's some evidence she has a quite strong evangelical base in Iowa still, so it's obviously that's a crucial...
Because Ted Cruz has got a serious evangelical following in Iowa,
which
Trump is very worried about.
And Freddie, why has Rubio not had that moment where he's suddenly got the momentum that everyone said that he was going to have, but which never seems to have materialised?
I think he's the star that never shines. And I think in the sort of mood of anti-politics, he is just too pristine a politician. He's good-looking, he wears funny heeled boots, he's Hispanic, so a lot of people sort of thought he could answer the Republicans' Hispanic immigration problem. And so the old white working class or middle class American voice really rejects him, I think.
That's a shame, really, because he has this wonderful stump speech that reduces me to tears anyway. You know, my father was a barmaid, my mother was a maid, and now I'm running for president. He's lived the American dream, the American immigrant dream. And really, that ought to communicate itself.
But I think Donald Trump says the American dream is dead, and that's what a lot of American people think.
It's not what they want to believe, though. I mean, the fight, certainly the blue-collar, what you might call, the stupid vote, you know, is inclined to go with the Trump simplistic message, especially after all those years of Obama, when he talks about making America great again, taking back world leadership, taking back influence in the world. That resonates because of Obama's withdrawal from world leadership. But it's so thin, that message. It's so thin. How long can he make that last?
Well, I think foreign policy is another area where the Republicans have lost the trust of the people. The people are angry about Iraq. They're angry about America's declining influence on the world.
But they're angry with Obama about that.
They're angry with Obama about it, but they're pretty angry with George W. Bush,
too. Yeah. It's very anti-establishment, this at this stage. Whether it will continue to be is the open question.
It is a long race.
That was Janet Daly and Freddie Gray discussing Donald Trump. Now, from one politician defying the odds to another, David Cameron is well ahead in the polls, even though around the world centre-right parties are imploding. James Forsyth writes in his politics column this week about the secret of David Cameron's success. James, how is the Prime Minister able to keep doing quite so well when other centre-right parties aren't?
Well, I think part of it is due to the success of the British economic model. The British economy, as today's unemployment figures show, is continuing to create jobs. That means that there isn't the same kind of anti-establishment rage that there is in the United States. I think he's also avoided doing stupid things. You know, Angela Merkel's problems are largely self-inflicted. It was her decision to throw open the floodgates and admit all of these refugees that has plunged her party and the whole German centre-right into crisis. But then there is something interesting about Cameron, which is during the 2015 election campaign, you'd have said many things about David Cameron, but not that he was interesting. This was a very disciplined campaign that hit, you know, very clear, simple messages repeatedly. But it's since winning re-election that I think he's become such an interesting figure. The Tories have done the living wage. You've seen Cameron talking about an all-out assault on poverty, an attempt to get true equality, and this whole anti-extremism strategy combined with this injunction to the country to celebrate the kind of greatest multiracial democracy the world has ever seen. I mean, it's in a weird way. Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, said in politics that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Cameron seems to have flipped that on its head.
Does that mean, if he's governing in poetry, that a lot of the initiatives he's announcing don't amount to very much?
I think that they are about social change. And I think that one of the things you see is that, you know, normally in government initiatives announcements, you know, if there's less than 100 million, it's fairly meaningless. And so it's very easy on the one hand to say 20 million to help Muslim women learn English is a pointless gesture. I mean, there is something different, though, because it's about Cameron trying to kind of set up kind of social norms and social change. And it's kind of much more back to the kind of Cameron of 2005, 2006, when, you know, the big thing he was going to do was to change society through using the kind of bully pulpit of his position.
Do you think a lot of those policies are thought through? The Muslim women policy that was announced on Monday attracted quite a lot of criticism, given that David Cameron had cut funding for courses to teach people who speak other languages English.
I think you can make arguments about what's been cut and what's not been cut. What I think is remarkable is the Birmingham MP Shabana Mahmood wrote a piece for The Times in which she basically seemed to criticise Cameron for challenging gender segregation and for challenging people's... There is a cultural question here about integration, which I think Cameron was rightly tackling. And I don't think it is, frankly, you know... If you want to come to a country and not learn English, you are not learn the language of that country, you are shutting yourself off from the rest of that country. And that is unhealthy for you, your community and the whole country. And I think Cameron is right on that.
So Cameron's winning the arguments about principles. Do you think he's winning the arguments about the design of policies, or is he not thinking so much about the design of policies yet?
I think this is the intriguing question, which is that, you know, I was talking to about the cabinet minister about Cameron's social reform agenda, and they said, look, you know, the thing is that this social stuff takes years to actually deliver. And I think one of the interesting things is that Tony, you know, there is a similarity between Blair and Cameron, which is it's both in their final term as Prime Minister, but they both seem to have kind of come into the job to have found what their real purpose is. But while as Blair wanted to pass specific pieces of legislation, and, you know, his message he kept saying to Gordon Brown was like, just let me pass this act about foundation hospitals or this act about education reform, and then I will go. What Cameron seems to be doing is to set in place a series of reforms that will take time to deliver. You know, for example, I think one of the things we're going to get a big push on is employment and university admissions rates for black and minority ethnic people in Britain. We won't know if Cameron has succeeded on that until long after he shut the door on number 10. So I think I think in a way that it is far too early to start saying whether this Cameron social reform stuff will succeed or not. And I think we won't really know for 5 to 10 years. But I think Cameron's also trying to do something else, which is he wants to change the Conservative Party. He wants his legacy to the party to be that all of this stuff becomes a kind of essential part of a Conservative pitch. And it's, I think what's interesting is, I mean, that you've seen Cameron become much more relaxed about Boris Johnson since party conference, when it became very obvious that Boris Johnson and George Osborne, despite the many stylistic differences between them, were essentially proposing the same strategic direction for the Tory party, which is very much building on this Cameron social mission, reaching out to low-pay Britain and the like.
And presumably Cameron's day-to-day life has become much easier with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader. But does it make it harder for him to ensure that he is bringing in good policies when you haven't got an opposition that is a strong flint to strike against?
I mean, there is an element of that. I think, first of all, I think it's worth reflecting on how much easier Cameron's job is now than it was a year ago. Not only does he not have another election to fight, he's running a single-party government rather than a coalition where you had to kind of constantly horse trade. And the Labour Party are just the most ineffective opposition in living memory. I think it's quite remarkable. You know, normally something like floods cause government's problem because there is the opposition gets on, starts to unpick decisions that were taken. I mean, even though there do seem to have been some highly dubious decisions made about flood defences, and particularly with regards to Leeds, you know, none of this has gained any political traction. We all see people who work in Number 10 now. They just look so much less harassed than they used to because life is just objectively easier for them now.
Is that a good thing?
I don't think that is a good thing, because I think actually, for good government, you need a good opposition. And you need someone to be sitting there thinking, I'm just going to double-check all these numbers and all these figures because we don't want to give the opposition any kind of opening. I think that pressure is gone. But I mean, on the other side, there is political space in which they can operate in. And the fact they have moved off just simply repeating long-term economic plan endlessly might not be a bad thing for politics.
A reminder of our special subscription offer for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. Now, while the centre-right appears to be struggling across the West, in Hollywood, the Academy Awards are on the verge of crisis after being accused of racism for not nominating enough black actors. Rod Little says in this week's magazine that the Oscars shun all the best stars regardless of race, while film critic Tim Robey has said the Academy has a big problem. I'm joined by both now. Tim, why have the Oscars ended up with no black actors or actresses at all this year?
It does feel like a really bad oversight. They've managed to kind of neglect to nominate some of the most acclaimed performances of the year, which have been nominated in all kinds of other awards outlets. For instance, Idris Elba in Beast of No Nation, very widely acclaimed performance, probably his best performance, and he missed out on Best Supporting Actor. And there are a number of other examples, Benicio del Toro, and also the director and star of Creed. And the same thing happened last year. This is the reason it's become a real kind of shitstorm this time. Forgive my language, but it's twice in a row. So what they've basically managed to do is collectively say that the 40 best performances in film across the last 2 years are all by white people, which feels quite hard to take, actually. And particularly when you look at another performance from last year, like David Oyelowo playing Martin Luther King in Selma, he missed out. It just feels really very odd that the Academy have managed to miss these opportunities, really. It's hardly having to reach very far to look for good work. And it does slightly lend credence to the idea that they're rather out of touch, way too white, way too old, and organisations really connect with what audiences want these days.
I think that's probably right. And it's an interesting thing. I mean, in the magazine this week, I talk about the film In the Heat of the Night, which was a wonderful film, made in 1967, directed by Norman Jewison, and which was generally regarded to be the film of the year. And indeed, it got loads and loads of Academy Awards, but none for Sidney Poitier, who was the co-star with Rod Steiger. And, you know, clearly the Steiger-Poitier thing was the important billing and the most important thing about the film. And no one black who was associated with the film got any awards at all, not even Quincy Jones, who did that marvellous soundtrack to it. And it's just a bit odd to find that the same sort of thing happens 60 years later, almost exactly 60 years later. I mean, my thought is that it's not simply about race, though that is undoubtedly an issue, but that over the years they have tended to go for the great epic films, the overblown epics, the ones which have had loads of money squandered on them, the ones with big box office stars in them, and often miss the edgy and interesting films, which a lot of us who enjoy films might argue are more deserving of the Academy Awards.
Tim, do you think that's right, that those who do the nominating have just got bad taste?
The taste is definitely questionable. And I would say even if, when they're not going for, what you know, a big epic film, they're often going for sort of an important film, if you like. So, you know, two years ago, they did go for 12 Years a Slave. You know, it won Best Picture, Best Supporting Actress, Best Adapted Screenplay. And those were black winners, you know, who came up on stage to collect. Then last year, they really missed a trick with Selma, which I do think was a really very good film. And they could have nominated for the first time a black woman as Best Director, Ava DuVernay, and they didn't. And there was sort of talk floating around that, you know, oh, well, we gave 12 Years a Slave its moment, so we're sort of off the hook for a year, if you like. You know, we can look at other issues, not just African-American history. But then again, this year, the problem they, in a way they face is that the black films in front of them didn't have that kind of sort of social pedigree, if you like. You know, one of them is Creed, which is the seventh sequel in the Rocky franchise. You know, and okay, Rocky won Best Picture back in 1976, but this time it's only nominated for a white guy, for Sylvester Stallone, as Best Supporting Actor. So as you pointed out, you know, they often sort of find a way to reward the white talent involved in films with largely black themes. And that's also the case with Straight Outta Compton, the biopic of the NYA, NWA band, the rappers, because the only nominee for that is the screenplay, and those are white writers. So they've, again, missed the chance to nominate the black talent behind that film. It's a very unfortunate set of nominations that have kind of emerged 2 years in a row. And it really does make it look as though they've got a serious problem, I think.
Rod, do you think there is a wider problem here with the film industry, or does the problem just lie with the Oscars?
No, I think it primarily lies with the Oscars. I mean, in fairness, if you look I know that there have been arguments which say that African Americans haven't had enough starring roles, don't get the really big meaty roles. I'm not sure that's absolutely true. There are a few African American actors which Hollywood seems to love. Such as Samuel L. Jackson and Lawrence Fishburne, and more besides, Will Smith. You can name them all, and they do tend to get good roles. And in fairness, you might argue that African Americans in Hollywood punch rather higher above their weight than they do in other occupations within the country. Now, you can argue as to whether that's a consequence of discrimination or whether it's a consequence of indigenous culture. I don't know. I mean, we just don't know. I think there's a wider problem with the Oscar nominations, and that's that it is staggering to me, not that Straight Outta Compton didn't get an award, though NWA themselves would undoubtedly find that hilarious. But, for example, the greatest actors and actresses of the last 20 or 30 years also don't get awards. It's remarkable, for example, that Jennifer Jason Leigh has never received an Academy Award.
Until this year, yeah, she's just
until
got
this one. Year, that's right, just got one this year. And, you know, you look at the body of work she did in the 90s and even in the 80s, for that matter, and, you know, stunning work. There are plenty of other actors like that. Dean Stockwell,
Edward G. Robinson was never nominated.
Edward G. Robinson, no, indeed. And from Paris, Texas, I forget his name now. You can help too.
You mean Harry Dean Stanton?
Harry Dean Stanton, yeah.
And finally, to both of you, there have been threats from a number of actors and directors that they might boycott the awards this year. as revenge for what they see as a very unfair set of nominations. Do you think that will work, Tim?
I mean, I think it's one way to highlight the problem. I mean, the other way to highlight the problem is actually to speak up about the problem, you know, on stage. And if Chris Rock continues to be the presenter this year, as he's meant to be, you can guarantee he's going to make a big deal out of it. I mean, he'll make jokes, but they will be half jokes, if that. You know, he's going to be really, I think, kind of going for the jugular. There's some talk, though, that he might actually kind of follow suit with the boycott and refuse to present. And I'm very undecided about which of those two sort of strategies, if you like, would call more helpful attention to the problem. Because just simply not turning up, I mean, yes, the Academy's president, who is actually African-American, is well aware that this year they've really kind of got egg on their face, that the set of nominations they've almost obliviously come up with makes them look more backward than ever before. And we do, as Rod points out, there are big African-American stars in Hollywood who have had their share of laurels. You know, Denzel Washington has won 2 Oscars, Halle Berry's won an Oscar, Sidney Poitier won an Oscar actually a few years before in The Heat of the Night.
Lilies of the Field, I believe, yes.
That's correct, yeah. So, you know, they've kind of, They've every so often they've handed out awards, and in fact in the supporting acting categories, black actors very often do quite well. Jennifer Hudson, Octavia Spencer, Whoopi Goldberg have all won Best Supporting Actress. But that feels like a sort of that. If there is a token way to reward an actor in some ways, it's in the supporting field. And I do feel as though with major performances like David Oyelowo's last year, and with Michael B. Jordan's this year in Creed, who I think is personally stronger than any of the people in the Best Actor category, they really need to kind of look at those performances properly, take them seriously, and to use the words of Spike Lee, do the right thing. Because I feel as though they've done the wrong thing this year, and that's what's got them into trouble.
Can I add one thing to that, especially as regards Chris Rock doing it? You might recall a very, very funny and extremely rude routine that Chris did, which was about this difference, a wonderful bit of satire, this difference between black folk and niggers. And it was hilarious, and it was hilarious because it came from Chris Rock. I do get the feeling that the Academy Awards nomination committee have somewhere in the back of their minds that distinction. So they're not going to give an Academy Award to Straight Outta Compton, you know, which doesn't fit in with their view of what black actors should be doing. Whereas, in a sort of way, Samuel L. Jackson and Lawrence Fishburne and people like that, and Will Smith, are sort of comfortable and safe as actors and do fit into their idea of what good acting should be.
And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to all of our guests for joining, and thank you for listening.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. The landlord Mike says you wrecked this place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.